I want to begin at this point a topic in the Bible that is of extreme importance, and that is Babylon. Babylon is a city, it is a system, it is a way of life, it is a part of culture that we see in the Bible stretching from the book of Genesis, very early in the book of Genesis, all the way through the Bible to the very end of the Bible, almost the last chapter. It doesn't get the last chapter because another city gets that chapter, and that's what God calls the New Jerusalem. But nonetheless, from the early pages of Genesis to the late pages of the book of Revelation, the subject of Babylon is a very important topic. It is an important one to understand from many different perspectives and angles. And most importantly, it's important, brethren, as to how you and I live in Babylon. How you and I conduct our lives today. We're going to talk about Babylon past. We're going to talk about Babylon future today. But we're also going to talk probably about the most important understanding that you and I can walk out of this room today on this topic of Babylon, and that is living or standing for God today in our own modern Babylon and understanding the implications that has for all of us within the church. Let's look at a phrase from a scripture in Revelation chapter 18 and verse 4, where in talking about Babylon, it says, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. God tells his people of all time, come out of her. Come out of her, my people. So he's speaking directly to the people of God at any given age, but most specifically at those who live in that age that the book of Revelation is addressing in the time of the day of the Lord and toward the conclusion of this age. We find ourselves challenged by God to come out of a system or a city, if you will, a culture derived from a location, derived from a city that surrounds us daily. If we are told to come out of Babylon, then it must mean that we are in it. And if we are in it, we have got to understand how that applies to us. The Babylon of the end is more than just a city. It's a cultural, economic, and political system that encompasses the entire world and pervades all parts of life. Like Daniel, who we read about in the book by his name, Daniel resisted Nebuchadnezzar. He resisted the Babylonian culture into which he was thrust as a young man. He lived, if you will, at the very seat of the beast. He went in and out of the beast's chamber every day when we really look at the book of Daniel and understand how it moves along. He lived among it, within it, and within Babylon, and yet he did not compromise. He kept his religion, as we say. He kept the faith. He didn't compromise his principles. He remained faithful to his calling and to the truth of God that he had known and he understood in his time. He loved the truth. And so must we. If we are to resist the Babylon in which we live, we must also understand the truth. We must embrace that truth and we must understand it. To gather all this together, we need to go back in time. We need to go back to the Babylon of the past and in the scriptures and begin to understand what it is exactly that the Bible teaches us of this subject. And when we go back to Genesis chapter 10, in a section there in verses 8, 9, and 10, we read of this post-flood period where the sons of Noah began to repopulate the earth at that particular point in time, and they went and their families began to grow, and they began to build in this particular area. The area that the Bible describes as Shinar. And we read of a specific location here where people began to follow an individual by the name of Nimrod. And here in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 8, we read of one of the descendants of Noah, Cush, giving birth to Nimrod, who began to be a mighty one in the earth. And it says that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, this is the only place in Scripture that we have a reference to this character called Nimrod, a rather enigmatic, legendary nefarious type character from the scriptures. Certain translations bring out a little bit of information that might help us have an insight into his character and the nature of what he was as a leader among men. That it says that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord, and some of the older translations say that that means that he was in place of the Lord, meaning that he attempted in the eyes of men to place himself above God and in place of God, and to get people to begin to look to him rather than to God. And we can imagine from our own perspective to today, as we know all the arguments to get people to turn their eyes off of God, we can begin to imagine perhaps in some of the arguments that Nimrod and his followers began to use to create a cult of personality, to create what we call a dictatorship, to get people to turn away from a God who destroyed the earth, after all, who flooded everyone out of existence, a cruel, angry, patriarchal type figure. I will take care of you. I will provide for you, Nimrod may have said. I will be the one that you will look to as Lord. I will provide for your daily needs. Don't even begin to look there. And so this is where he began. And it says that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And this is a spot, the geographic location there in that part of the world that we know of today as modern-day Iraq, which we have quite a presence in and quite an interest in our world today with the American forces, the incursion that we went in with now 3 years ago into that part of the world to upset the balance of power and to make certain changes. That's where it began. That's where the story of Babylon, the story of Babel, begins in the scriptures. Now, we read of a erection of a tower, the building of a city in this location in the next chapter of Genesis, where we find the building of this Tower of Babel, as it is called. It says, beginning in verse 1, that the earth was of one language and of one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks, bake them thoroughly, and come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." And so the inhabitants of the city here began to build this tower. And this infamous tower has taken on many different depictions by artists down through the centuries to illustrate exactly what it is that that the Bible is talking about. But we all know the story and should understand the story as it began to develop, because God came down, walked among the people and observed what was taking place, and made a decision that it couldn't go on, that it would not go on. Now, again, we have to understand as we try to read between the lines exactly what that meant, but we know that God confounded the languages, scattered the peoples, and, if you will, civilization, the whole course of civilization, was dealt a setback by that. Because God said, look, if this goes on, there will be nothing that will be withheld from them. And you have to imagine that the plan of God, or the advance of civilization and the advance of human work, would have probably gone on at a much, much faster pace than what we have seen when we look backwards from our point of view on world history. And God has a plan, as Mr. Weber was talking this morning. He has a purpose, and that's on a timetable according to his timing, not according to human timing, and not even what these humans were going to accomplish then, as they sought to take time, sought to take culture, civilization into their own hands, and build their Babel of autocracy and power unto themselves to the exclusion of God. None of that was going to happen ultimately to upset God's purpose and plan. And so I think, as we all realize, brethren, with the confusion of tongues, God effectively put a collar, if you will, upon the advance of civilization. If there's one thing that divides people today and has geographically, historically, and culturally, it is language. And it, to this very day, continues to keep the nations separated and to retard certain areas of progress. If we were all of one language, then we would have seen a completely different picture. But God didn't let it happen. And so they were scattered. And it was set back, and it was destroyed, whatever it was they were building, however far it got up to at that point. I don't know. Do you ever wonder what exactly that building looked like and how high it would have gone? And when we look at our own modern skyscrapers and we see what human engineering can do today, what they may have accomplished, the materials in that part of the world then were not much different than what they are now, mud and brick, mud and straw into brick. So I have a hard time personally imagining that it was something that equals any of the buildings we've made today. That's not necessarily the point. The real point that God is telling us here is that this was a culture that was on a collision course with God's way of life. It had already deviated, and it would have gone on at a much faster rate with all the attendant problems that one can imagine had it not changed. But it did change, and we begin to pick up in Genesis chapter 12 God's dealing in his efforts with one family, one man, Abram, and the descendants of Abram, who became largely grown into the nation of Israel ultimately. From Genesis 12 on, we begin to see the Bible through the eyes of God's working with the descendants of that one man, Abraham and his descendants. But the story of Babylon, the story of Babel, is not over. And in fact, from that point on, as we learn about Babylon, it is largely in conjunction with the story that is going on with the nation of Israel. And how as they come into contact with the Israelites. Because when we come down, we fast forward several hundred years to the time of Israel as a nation, and the rise of empires, we begin to see an empire arise that is the Babylonian Empire. Mr. Rhodes mentioned this morning that this is where, in one sense, history begins. And it's a good point, especially when you tie in what we know from the Bible, from the book of Daniel about the great empires prophesied to arise, beginning with Babylon, in terms of the history that applies to prophecy, God's plan, and Israel, God's people, it does really begin here with this particular empire, the Babylonian Empire, which became quite large for its time. It consolidated and grew out of the Assyrian Empire, took it over, came down into, and ultimately came into contact with the nation that we are well familiar with, which is the nation of Judah. And it's this contact of Babylon, the empire, with Judah that began to make an entire change there, because that's where the story comes in, initially with King Hezekiah, where certain emissaries from Babylon came to Jerusalem. Hezekiah interacted with them, but then as the Babylonian empire grew, then they ultimately began to make incursions, and they piecemeal over a period of time chipped away at the nation of Judah, which was the remnant of the great Israel empire of its time, from the time of David and later Solomon. And Babylon began to make incursions against it. And it was in that first effort that they made against Jerusalem that Daniel and many of his friends were taken to Babylon and began to be incorporated into the system of the Babylonian Empire at that particular time. But this is where it began to rise, and it began to make a difference. Ultimately, under Nebuchadnezzar, the kingdom of Babylon reached its highest point. Now, when we understand what this means, and we look at this man and his connection with Daniel, his connection with what we find there in the book of Daniel, we see a man who is at the peak of his powers, at the peak of his abilities, and he is being dealt with by God through his servant Daniel. As I already mentioned, being an individual who'd already proven himself, we read in chapter 1 of Daniel where he proved that he would not compromise with his values, with his truth, and what he had learned. And Nebuchadnezzar is beginning to realize through the story we find in Daniel that there is a God who does rule in the heavens. And that it is not just the wealth of Babylon, the power that he has built at this particular point in time, that is of the utmost value or the utmost importance. In fact, he has to learn many lessons the hard way. Babylon is a very interesting city, state, empire, to understand and to examine from a historical basis. Again, when we keep in mind that Nebuchadnezzar, being that head of gold that we read about in Daniel chapter 2, it was a very fine empire. It was a very wealthy empire. It was the head, which means, if you understand the body analogy, which we all do, that it's the head that directs the body. It's the head that controls what the rest do. Babylon, in many ways, was the precursor of all the other empires that eventually developed. And in many ways, what was laid down in Babylon existed and continued on through the other empires, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman Empire, that succeeded Babylon. But what Babylon did in terms of economics, science, religion, didn't necessarily disappear. And therein, it's important for us to understand exactly some of the historical points there. Will Durant, in his magisterial work on world history, world civilization, has some very interesting comments to make about Babylon in his section there. He mentions that Babylon almost created astronomy. He said that Babylon added richly to the progress of the medical arts. They established the science of language. Babylon prepared the first great codes of law. Babylon taught the Greeks the rudiments of mathematics, physics, and philosophy. And Babylon passed on to the Arabs part of that scientific and architectural lore with which they aroused the dormant soul of medieval Europe. So even stretching into the Arab culture of the later period, Babylon had an influence because of its position, because of what it had accomplished. And so we should understand that when, as empires come and go, their contributions to culture and civilization don't always vanish and evaporate. And that's very true when it comes to Babylon. That what existed there in terms of a spirit, an attitude, and even certain concrete advancements and contributions to civilization have continued on. When you understand the wealth of Babylon, it helps us to, again, appreciate some of the current, modern, and future applications to this of this term to a yet future revival of Babylon in a different system. Babylon was what they call a theocratic state. In other words, the religion and the priests of Babylon, the chief deity of the time of the Chaldeans was Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K. And his temple was the prominent religious building within the city of Babylon, the temple of Marduk. But it was a theocratic state. And the priests of Babylon, the Chaldean priests, had a tremendous amount of power. That's why when you read there in Daniel 2 and the other chapters, when Nebuchadnezzar would have a dream, when there was a question within the political court just down the street from the temple, it was the priests, the magicians, the sorcerers that we see that were called in. There's a reason for that. You don't get called into the throne room, into the Oval Office of the day, unless you're in the loop, unless you have influence, which is the coin of the realm within any political system. And they did. One of the reasons that they did is because they had a great deal of money. As Babylon grew through its conquests, through all of its various services, and the flow of money coming into Babylon, came into the temple treasuries. It came into and was controlled from every part of the nation by the priests. Taxes from the land, spoils from conquest, even the kings, who of course themselves grew very wealthy, but in order to assuage their guilt, to curry favor with the priests and with the gods, they also gave a great portion of their wealth into the temple granaries and into the temple treasuries. Now, the priests who controlled this were just like any other group of human beings at any given time. You grow fabulously wealthy and you can literally only consume so much upon yourself. Eventually, then you have to take that and invest it. You have to put it off into other pursuits. And that's what the priests did in Babylon as well. They became investment bankers. They became the Merrill Lynch, and the Edward Jones, and the Sachs Goldman, and all the various names that we know today that are the centers of finance that control a great deal of the world commerce. That was held in the hands of the priests back during the time of ancient Babylon. They became the financiers of the nation. They handled and were involved with a great deal of the nation's trade. They had a reputation for wise investment, and people entrusted their money with them. Just like you and I entrust our money with a brokerage firm, people would entrust their money in ancient Babylon with a form of what the temples and the priests had had accomplished. They gave money out at usury, at rates, favorable rates of interest at times. Over the years in the Babylonian Empire, kings came and went. But the priesthood and the religious cult endured. That's very important to understand. Durant writes in his book, he says, the council of priests, free from the fortunes of elections, illnesses, assassinations, and wars, had a corporate perpetuity that made possible long-term and patient policies, such as characterize great religious organizations to this day. It was fated that the merchants would make Babylon, but the priests would enjoy it. The merchants would make Babylon, but the priests would enjoy it. But did you catch that one phrase? That what they made possible through patient long-term policies, such as characterize great religious organizations to this day. That's part of the legacy of Babylon. That what we find within the religion, in terms of the cult and the traditions and the teachings that are well documented throughout history and are understood, and even their transmission into modern religious form is well known. But it was also done through a great deal of economic power and the control of the flow of capital within the country. That's important for us to understand as we look at Babylon, certainly of the present and more importantly in the future. Now, as I mentioned, Nebuchadnezzar came in contact with Judah. Nebuchadnezzar, certainly as we read in the Bible, was a man that was not devoid of ego. He had a great high opinion of himself. But it was under Nebuchadnezzar that Babylon reached its peak, and the city with its great walls and its buildings. And if there were the Hanging Gardens, one of the so-called wonders of the ancient world, some historians and archaeologists debate back and forth whether there even was the Hanging Gardens. They're not mentioned in the Bible, but that's what comes down to us initially from Herodotus, the Greek historian. But that was, if that was in existence, it was during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, as he built Babylon to its highest point. And I think we realize as we look at what he did there, as we find in the book of Daniel, the first few chapters, that he built it quite large and had a very high opinion of himself. And yet God was dealing with him as that head of gold, as Daniel identified him, to teach him a lesson that it was God who ruled in the nations, that it was ultimately God who set up rulers and had rulers taken down according to his will and plan. That it didn't happen on that scale without God's knowing it, God's approval, and God being involved. Because God is the God of Abraham is a God of history. And Nebuchadnezzar came to a point where he had to learn that. I'll talk in my last presentation this afternoon about the period of his 7 years of insanity where as he more or less shook his fist at God and defied God, he was brought low and had to be like the beasts of the field for a period of 7 years. But Nebuchadnezzar eventually died, even after he came back to his sanity. And Babylon went on for a period of time until we come to the event that we read about in Daniel chapter 5, where on the feast of Belshazzar's feast, as depicted in this very well-known painting by the Dutch painter Rembrandt, the Persians were at the gates. This is in the year 539 B.C., in October, the autumn period of the 539 B.C., and Belshazzar, as we read in the biblical account, was in his palace giving a big party. And the hand appeared out of nowhere and wrote upon the wall, essentially basically telling Belshazzar and Babylon that it's coming to an end. Time's up. Someone else is coming on the scene. And a man named Cyrus was at the gate. And the story is told in history is that they diverted the Euphrates River and came in under the great gates, according to the prophecy from Isaiah, prophesied long before, and they conquered the city. And Babylon, as a city, was taken over by the Persians. Now, the city went on. It didn't necessarily totally collapse at that time. There was a certain amount of requisite pillage for the time and all that goes on with that. In that particular scene. But Babylon went on because the Persians used it. Alexander the Great, the Greek emperor, he used it as well. If you happen to see the movie that came out here about a year and a half ago about Alexander the Great, probably the best part of the movie, the only part of the movie I would want to go back and see it a second time for, were the tremendous computer-generated graphics that they made of the city of Babylon when Alexander enters the city. It was I just wish they'd shown more of that and less of some of the other scenes that they felt they had to put in to try to spice that movie up for modern audiences. They really blew it on that movie, as far as I'm concerned, in telling the story of Alexander the Great. But they did have some great computer graphics of what Babylon looked like. But the point was, Alexander wanted to use it as his capital. Well, Alexander the Great died in Babylon. He didn't get to realize his dream. He died there. And the city lived on and was around even into and beyond the period of the first century during the Roman period. But it had been eclipsed by Athens and then later by Rome and eventually declined. And ultimately, the city disappeared and was no longer used. The river Euphrates actually changed its course. And where it goes through that period, that part of the world today, is not exactly where it went through at the time of the city of Babylon. The winds came and the rains brought it down, and dust and sand covered it over. And not until modern times has the city been excavated, and an attempt to recreate it as an archaeological park was undertaken during the time that Saddam Hussein ran the country, and has more or less, I'm sure, in the recent years come to a halt. But it's an archaeological park. One of the reasons I would certainly hope, one of my big dreams is to someday go to see the site of ancient Babylon, but I don't want to go there yet. I hope that, maybe that part of the world can return to a sense of normalcy, and maybe that would be a trip that some of us could make at some point in the future and actually see the ruins of that city. But that's all that's left, are excavated ruins of the ancient city of Babylon. And when you look at what that means, for it's not inhabited today, the prophecies came to pass, and Babylon came to a close. Babylon, indeed, as the scripture says, is fallen. But we read in the scriptures of another Babylon of the future, another Babylon that is to come, one that is described in Revelation chapter 17, a different type of Babylon that we read about. Mr. Rhodes referred to it this morning. I'm not going to repeat all that he went through, but his presentation set the stage for this. But in Revelation 17 and chapter 18 of Revelation, we begin to see a description of a modern city that is labeled Babylon the Great. And we see that this is a city that is going to set the cultural and religious standards for an end time, political, religious empire that is part of what is called here in Revelation the Beast, and a system or an entity that a woman rides here. And so we see a rise of a future Babylon, of a woman riding a beast, and this whole system in verse 5 of Revelation 17 is called Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. Babylon, within the scriptures, when you put all of these together, and especially what we read about here in these two chapters in Revelation, come to represent a realm of the devil, a realm that is understood as the archetypical head of all other entrenched worldly resistance to God. The Interpreter's Bible Dictionary has this to say about Babylon. It says, Babylon is an age-long reality, including idolatrous kingdoms as diverse as Sodom, Gomorrah, Egypt, Tyre, Nineveh, and Rome. Babylon, the mother of all harlots, is the great source and reservoir of enmity to God, as well as the objectified product of the one mind that we read about here in Revelation 17. One mind that gives power and authority to false gods, and as such, the article goes on, is the antithesis of the virgin bride of Christ, the holy city, the New Jerusalem, the kingdom of God. We have two cities talked about here. This is the city of Jerusalem, the city of God, and the city of Babylon that is described here that reigns over the kings of the earth, because verse 18 does specifically talk about this Babylon being as a great, that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. And that is what we have described here by John as a city that has been revived. Now, there's a school of thought among prophetic students that Babylon, as a city in the modern nation of Iraq, will be resurrected. And that this Babylon of Revelation 17 will be on the site of the ancient Babylon that we've just gone through. But is the Bible speaking something completely different? I believe that it is. The woman John describes is a worldwide religious system. And it's based in a city, as we see in verse 18. But its roots are in ancient Babel and Babylon. There is only one city, one religion, that matches that description today. And that city is Rome, which is Vatican City, as again was brought out this morning, which is the seat of the Roman Catholic Church. And when we look at what John says here in chapter 17 under the inspiration of God's Holy Spirit, we can begin to put this together and understand what it is that we are talking about. Because the woman John describes is a worldwide religious system that's based in this city. He says here in verse 1 that the city, or that the woman that is described, is a great harlot that sets on many waters. Verse 2, it is described as having committed fornication, that the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. Again, that was described this morning. The reference to fornication between the woman, which is this Babylonish system, and the kings is a spiritual symbolism of a marriage or a relationship based on convenience of getting and taking. And again, the historical descriptions of the conflict between church and state during this 2,000 years speak for themselves. This particular city is unfaithful to God. It must therefore, and does, claim a relationship to God, which in these chapters, God says, it shows us He is going to eventually repudiate that relationship, and He's going to do it before all the world. For hundreds of years, the Roman Catholic Church has claimed to be the mother church of Christianity, and its popes have historically claimed to be the vicar of Christ. And this belief is well documented down through history. That's who the head of that organization sets in place of and rules for and speaks for in terms of the religious teaching and the religious indoctrination. The scene here of St. Peter's is a well-known scene, and I think we all remember the scenes just 1 year ago with the death of John Paul II and the month-long ritual that was enacted before us all of the death of the Pope, the burial of the Pope, and then the election of a new Pope. But what to me was probably the most dramatic of that during that period of time was the funeral of John Paul II and the assemblage of kings and presidents and prime ministers, royalty from around the world, sitting there in St. Peter's Square during that funeral service. That was, some said at the time, the greatest gathering of world leaders of our modern period in that spot. And I'm sure that many of us grasp the significance of that. But I think for most people watching it today in our world, they didn't fully grasp with understanding that comes from these scriptures of the power, the influence, and what that means. Now, the influence is not as great as it once, it was 1,000 years ago. But still, to bring people together, leaders of heads of state, for that particular event is a very significant thing for us to note and to understand. We'll talk more about that later on today. But this is what we saw, and this is what that great city that reigns over the kings of the earth and interacts with them is all about. The scripture also shows us here in verse 6 where John describes that this woman is drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. John Paul II made a historic apology during his pontificate for the decades or centuries of persecution by those who acted on behalf of the church. And it was a very carefully crafted apology, as statements from any organization happen to be, business, religious, whatever it may be. The wording was exact. The apology was careful not to say that the church had erred, merely that human beings had erred. And they did not, because the church in Catholic theology cannot sin, can do no wrong. And so there was a very carefully worded apology. But nonetheless, it brought to the world attention for a brief period of time the long record of death and injustice inflicted on those who dared to oppose or differ with the doctrine of that organization down through the centuries. Historians say that Christian Rome, once Rome became converted to Christianity, Christian Rome killed far more Jews than did pagan Rome. Last fall, we were in Israel after the Feast of Tabernacles. We went through the Holocaust Museum at Yad Vashem, the shrine there to the victims of the Holocaust in World War II. And there at the very beginning exhibits of the museum, as you walk through it, there was a very interesting display about anti-Semitism. And they are very, very copious in documenting the statements from Augustine and the record of the church in its complicity with the anti-Semitic acts of the Holocaust and throughout history. And they go all the way back to Augustine to show the origins of many of those feelings that have been carried out through the years of persecution and Holocaust, particularly upon the Jews. They're very direct about it. They pull no punches in the Holocaust Museum there in Jerusalem. And this particular statement, this phrase, has come to the fore. Now, the scripture also talks about the fact that it says that this great city reigns over the kings of the earth. And from the crowning of Charlemagne on Christmas Day in 800 to all the various conflicts with the state and Holy Roman emperors down through the centuries, this struggle and this very fact is very well documented in terms of what this city and the church within it has had the power to do, and not just to crown rulers, but also to sell people and to deal in the lives of people as well. Pope Clement IV had the power to sell millions of his fellow Italians to a French king in return for an annual fee. And he did. This was part of the history. Again, it's documented. It can be brought out, but with our modern, multicultural, tolerant world, we don't necessarily like to talk about those or find those talked about. I want to make one point before I leave this particular area. In the last decade of the first century, when John received the revelation on the Isle of Patmos and the book was written, the last decade of the first century, only one city would John and the Church of God of his day, only one city would have been identified as Babylon in his thinking. In the thinking of the Church of God members sitting in a stone bench of the house or the courtyard of a small house where this revelation would have been read to them on a Sabbath afternoon, and they came to chapter 17 and they read about this system called Babylon, there's only one city that they would have conjured up in their mind to be the fulfillment of what John was talking about, what Christ was revealing to John. It was Rome. Rome had sacked Jerusalem by the time this book was written. Rome had killed the apostles Peter and Paul. Rome had persecuted hundreds and thousands, putting them to the death of members of the Church of God. Rome had put John on the island of Patmos. There's no question what they would have thought about as they read this book. For the past 15 centuries, Rome has been ruling through its pagan-derived rituals and traditions and teachings. No other city in history meets the exact criteria that are described by John here in the book of Revelation. And so, with that in mind, we come to Babylon the Great is fallen, and to the future, and to a modern Babylon that is described here in Revelation 17, and particularly in chapter 18 in great detail. It's a fascinating read to go through that chapter and to look at it in light of our globalized society today and to begin to realize how that could all come to pass. The Babylon to come is more than a city. It is a global system that will dominate trade in the world economy unlike any system before. It will rise out of today's system, which is continually moving in the direction of a global state. We talk about globalization today. We write about it. We try to understand it, and we do live it. It impacts your life and mine. creates jobs in China, in India, in Latin America, changes the way whole things are done, creates scenarios. The very idea of a Arab, British, or other foreign entity, China, controlling, running, managing one of our ports of entry is all part of a global world that has come about in the last 3 to 4 decades, and something that would have never been imagined 40 years ago. But it's a reality today. And it continues to develop. Our world today is poised for a number of dramatic changes. Out of the war currently going on in Iraq and the war on terror are going to come additional shifts that we are yet to see clearly defined in the various alliances on the world stage and among the various powers that currently are the players on the world. What we see now is not the way it will be when these events in the book of Revelation unfold. And I'll come back to that in my second presentation here this afternoon. But brethren, what is important for you and I to understand is how it impacts us. Our spiritual Babylon. Our everyday world. And again, we have to come back to the reality of the world we live in. And what Christ says here in Revelation 18 and verse 4, which is to come out of this world. Again, we have to go back to Daniel and recognize that Daniel's example, so important to go back to, it's one of my favorite stories in the Bible. And I need to get a little boost of encouragement, a little bit of focus and redirection in my life. I always like to go to Daniel because he lived in Babylon. As I said earlier, he walked in and out of the Oval Office of the Beast. Not that the beast today is in an oval office. That's not necessarily what I mean. But Nebuchadnezzar was an imposing personality. And you read the confidence, the courage that Daniel faced that man with. It came from an inner conviction of a man who had not compromised with the truth. He loved the truth. He had not compromised with his values and with his convictions. You see, Daniel stood in ancient Babylon, but for him, it was modern Babylon. Daniel didn't get up every morning, walk out onto his terrace and look out, oh boy, it's so good to be living in the ancient time. To Daniel, it was the present. For you and I, the present is our Babylon. We live in a world that's not tuned to direct us to God. And we have to each day kind of go back, if you will, mentally to the example of a Daniel that wouldn't compromise on what might be to some to be the smallest of items. He wouldn't compromise on any of it. And certainly didn't compromise on one of the most important, which was prayer. And as a result, he could stand in the Babylon of his time. And as a result of that, Daniel came out spiritually of the Babylon in which he lived. And that's the challenge for you and I today, to examine our lives, where we live, and to make sure that we indeed are coming out of, because these words are talking to you and I right now, and it means that we are in our own Babylon, not the larger one yet to come, but if we're to survive that, if it happens in our lifetime, we've got to be sure of where we stand, to be able to recognize and identify the difference between righteousness and unrighteousness, between good and evil. And understand our world and understand where we live.